Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. This time of year, many of us are planning summer trips to see family or taking off for a week with family. Sister, brother, parents, they're in our plans and on our minds. And family is center stage in a slew of new titles, a diverse group of thrillers, comedies, and nonfiction. A wise man once said, "A happy family is but an earlier heaven." Yes, but when there are challenges, bumps along the way, twists and turns, it makes for a compelling read. Today we'll preview titles making their way up the bestseller charts, and we'll speak with author Randy Susan Myers. She's just out with a thought-provoking story you may want to add to your summer reading list. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. When Kate, single mom and law firm partner, gets an urgent phone call summoning her to her daughter's exclusive private school, she's shocked. Amelia had been suspended for cheating, something completely out of character for her overachieving, well-behaved daughter. Kate rushes to Grace Hall. When she arrives, she finds a situation beyond comprehension. Her daughter is dead. Despondent over having been caught cheating, Amelia jumped from the school's roof. At least that's the story Grace Hall and the police tell Kate. Overcome by grief, Kate struggles to come to grips with this life-shattering news. Then she gets an anonymous text. Amelia didn't jump. The moment she sees that message, Kate knows it's true. Clearly, Amelia had secrets and a life Kate knew nothing about. Racked by guilt, Kate is determined to find out what those secrets were and who could have hated her daughter enough to kill. She searches through Amelia's emails, texts, and Facebook updates, piecing together the last troubled days of her daughter's life. Kimberly McCrate's Reconstructing Amelia was a 2014 Edgar and Anthony nominee, a stunning exploration of the secret world of teenagers, their clandestine first loves, hidden friendships, and the dangerous cruelty that can spill over into terrible acts of betrayal. Christine Havem performs the book.
Kate, October 24th. Kate knew Victor wasn't happy, even before she looked up from her notes to see the anger settling over his face in a heavy cloud. The room was silent. Everyone, 5 lawyers from Sloan Thayer, 10 from Associated Mutual Bank, waiting for him to say something. Instead, Victor leaned back in his conference room chair, hands folded neatly in his lap. With his salt-and-pepper hair and perfectly tailored suit, he looked handsome and dignified, despite his obvious annoyance. Amid the uncomfortable quiet, Kate's stomach growled. She cleared her throat and shifted in her chair, hoping no one had heard. She'd been too nervous this morning to eat. There'd been the meeting, but there'd also been the argument she'd been bracing to have with Amelia. The argument had never materialized. Instead, Amelia had left for school with a smile and a cheerful wave, leaving Kate late for work and with an excess of unused adrenaline. Kate glanced longingly at the endless array of bagels and fruit and sweets laid out on the conference room sideboard. But when you were running a client meeting in the place of Jeremy Firth, the beloved head of litigation at Sloan Thayer, you didn't get up to grab a snack in the middle of it.
"You do realize," Victor said, pointing at Kate, "that complying with this subpoena will nullify any later objections."
"I understand your frustration, Victor," Kate said calmly. "But SEC is within its rights to..."
"Within its rights?" Victor snapped. "Overcompensating is more like it."
Kate held Victor's stare, which had morphed into something more of a glare. Vacillating now, even in the slightest, would be fatal. Victor would surely demand to see Jeremy, and while Kate might be a partner, she was still a junior one. She needed to be able to handle this on her own.
"And what about merit? Doesn't that..."
Before Victor could finish his thought, the phone in the conference room rang, startling everyone. Rebecca, the junior associate, dutifully hustled to answer it as Victor turned back to Kate.
I want our objections made part of the official record, and I want a budget for this whole mess before anyone opens a single box of documents. Do that, and you've got your document collection. Agreed?
As though Kate would be pocketing the extra firm earnings herself. In fact, she wouldn't benefit at all, beyond Jeremy's appreciation. That wasn't inconsequential, of course. Remaining one of Jeremy's favored disciples mattered a lot.
Absolutely, Victor, Kate said. We'll certainly do our best to...
Excuse me, Kate, said a voice in her ear.
When Kate glanced up, Rebecca looked petrified to be interrupting.
Sorry, but your secretary's on the phone. She says there's a call you need to take.
Kate felt her face flush. Taking a call in the middle of a meeting with Victor Stark was even worse than grabbing a bagel. Kate's secretary, Beatrice, would never have interrupted that kind of meeting. But she was out sick. Kate had told her replacement not to disturb her unless it was an absolute emergency. But the girl had had such a blank look on her face that Kate was convinced she was high. Unfortunately, refusing the call wasn't an option either. Kate was waiting to hear back from a judge's clerk about her application for a temporary restraining order for another client.
"Excuse me for one moment, please," Kate said, trying to make it seem as though the interruption was all very expected. "I'll just be a second."
We've just heard Reconstructing Amelia by Kimberly McCrate. Randy Susan Meyer's newest title is Accidents of Marriage. Her writing is influenced by her work with victims of domestic violence and her experience with young people impacted by street violence. She lives in Boston, where she teaches writing seminars at the Grub Street Writer Center. She is also a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post. Welcome, Randy, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me, Elaine.
Accidents of Marriage explores the damaging effects of spouses' emotional abuse. Why this novel now?
Well, this novel now because it came to me just at the right time to write it, I suppose. I was driving and on my way to work, and I worked with batterers. And I was thinking how they never really mean to do the damage they do, except for a few. And that collateral damage can just echo through an entire family for generations. And I was entering a very scary rotary, and the idea came to me in one fell swoop. Driving, road rage, damaging family, and it really was the wind at my back.
Will you begin the book with a fabulous quote by Frida Kahlo? "There have been two great accidents in my life. One was the trolley and the other was Diego. Diego was by far the worst." This really sets the scene for the book. How did you choose it?
Quote, I was actually searching for a title, a new title for my book. And I was doing what I always do, you know, reading poetry, reading quotations, and that one just leapt out at me. It's like, wow, that is my book.
Introduce us to Maddie and Ben.
For Maddie, Ben is the love of her life, and he's her blessing, and he's her curse. He's brilliant and charming when he wants to be, but he turns into a raging bull when he's crossed. Maddie is a social worker and very sure of herself at work, and then comes home and, like so many people, can't translate her work into her life, and she waits for the sound of the door opening to see what mood he's going to be in. And she tiptoes around him and is grateful for the good times and takes pills to cope with the bad times. And the only time she can really, really stand up to him is for the sake of her kids.
Tell us a little about Emma, their daughter.
Emma is a typical 14-year-old in many ways. She wants to be with her friends. She wants to be with her boyfriend. But she's also a little confused because she sees her mother giving in to her father too much. And then when an accident happens and she ends up responsible for so much of the family's well-being, Emma, she's both able to step up to the plate and incredibly terrified and incredibly angry. And also, as somebody who has a Jewish mother and a Catholic father, is torn between maybe I could turn to religion for some help, but she doesn't know which one.
You know, as the story progressed, of course, my heart was breaking for Maddie, but more so for Emma. How have your readers reacted?
Readers, I do a lot of book clubs, and readers absolutely fall in love with Emma and want to know what happens to her, and they feel like she's just getting the raw end of everything, which was my intention to show how the children in the family, when there's a trauma, the children get shunted aside. I hadn't originally intended to do her point of view, but it became clear early on that she was really strong part of the story.
You know, what was it like to unfold the story from three points of view, Maddie, Ben, and Emma?
I actually love doing that. I've done that in all of my books. I'm doing it in the book I'm working on now. I like to think of a family being sort of like, you know, blind people describing an elephant, depending on which part they're touching. Is how they'll describe it. And I think families are like that. Every family is different from each member. It's sort of like if you have sisters or brothers and you talk about your family growing up and there are times you think you had different parents.
Right. When I was reading the book, I really wondered where and how you draw the line between a guy who is blowing off steam and a guy with real anger issues. What's the difference?
Well, one of the things that I learned working in the field of domestic violence is that there really aren't those lines. It's a continuum from the most angelic people in the entire world, wherever they may be, to the most abusive. And all of us at some point fall somewhere on that line, further towards abuse than we want to be, more abusive. And the way I learned this was by working with abusive men and thinking I was going into, you know, be like the Mother Teresa of nonviolence, and realizing very quickly that there were many times I didn't manage my own anger. Yelling at my kids. Why was I yelling at my kids? It wasn't teaching them anything. It was just blowing off my own steam. So when does it become abuse? I will often tell women the moment that you ask the question, probably become abusive, however your husband is acting, and vice versa.
We're speaking with Randy Susan Myers on The Book Report. So as the story unfolds, of course, Maddie suffers traumatic brain injury, which was so gut-wrenching. Your writing gets it so right. How did you do the research for that part of the book, and do you know someone who suffers from TBI?
I do know somebody whose husband suffered very greatly from TBI. And who wrote, and she read the book, and, you know, to keep me honest. I also read so many memoirs, every memoir I could find out there from anybody in the family, including people who suffered from it.
Do most of your readers hope the family will stay together?
That is so fascinating. Most of them do. There's a few that don't, but and there seems to be some sort of a litmus test. I just haven't figured out for what exactly yet.
So are you already at work at a next book, and are you going to resurrect any of these characters?
Oh, I don't think they're going to be in this book. I'm about three-quarters of the way through my first draft of my next book, and this one is all about finding out that your husband has lied about his work and his riches, your whole marriage, from both points of view, from somebody who's basically operating a Ponzi scheme, who's very well respected.
Oh, boy. Any final thoughts about Accidents of Marriage?
I have to say I really loved writing that book. It was a difficult one. But I think the ways in which we don't recognize the effect of our actions on our family is such an important thing. And I really wanted to dramatize that, and I hope I have.
The book is so impactful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Randy.
Thank you so much for having me, Elaine. You be well.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Accidents of Marriage, performed by Susan Bennett.
Maddie crouched next to Caleb, her stomach dropping at the sight of blood pouring from his foot. Shards of glass surrounded him, liquid droplets of milk clinging to the pieces, a larger white puddle pooling on the wooden floor. She grabbed a wadded-up napkin to staunch the blood, crouching awkwardly to avoid cutting her knees. Gracie's mouth trembled. "I just got up, that's all, and I knocked over his milk glass. He got mad and screamed, then he stood up and kicked the glass and it broke. He stepped on it. It wasn't my fault." "It's okay, Gracie." Blood soaked through the napkin, dissolving the paper as she exerted pressure. "Emma, get me a damp towel." "This was preventable," Ben would say. "This is why we have plastic glasses." "Make it stop, Mommy." Tears cut through the dirt on Caleb's cheeks. She pressed harder. Gracie mopped the spilled milk with a dirty t-shirt from her backpack. "Here." Emma held out a dripping kitchen towel. "You need to wring it out, Emma. Never mind, just get a clean one." Emma stomped out with Gracie in her wake. Wet cloth slapped in the sink. "Give this to Mom." Emma's voice from the kitchen was extra loud. Using the hem of her black cotton skirt, Maddie covered the napkin. Gracie returned with a new towel. Emma watched from the doorway, twirling the bottom of her long brown braid. Maddie peeled away her skirt and replaced it with the towel, Caleb whimpering. "Do I have to go to the doctor?" He squinted as he peeked under the towel. "It doesn't look too deep, but it has to be cleaned," she said. "I don't think we need a doctor." Maddie's pulse calmed. She stopped rushing ahead in her mind. Wrapping Caleb's foot safely enough to hold in the bleeding until they got to the emergency room, packing the kids in the car, calling Ben. She looked again, making sure her decision was based on wisdom and not wishful thinking. It wasn't gaping. The bleeding had slowed. He tried to pull his foot away. "No, no cleaning, it'll hurt." Emma squatted next to them. "You let Mom wash out the cut and I'll play Monopoly." Caleb's smile came through like a sun shower. "That's sweet, honey." Maddie should appreciate Emma's goodness and stop losing patience with her sulks and eye rolling. "Thank you." "Can I play?" Gracie asked. "No," said Caleb. "Just me and Emma." Gracie's lip quivered at her brother's words, leaving Maddie torn between soothing and yelling stop it, especially when she saw Gracie make the tiny sign of the cross she'd picked up from Grandma Frances, Ben's mother, a woman given to reflexive ritual blessings. Gracie's gesture unsettled Maddie. Next thing she knew, her daughter would be genuflecting at Our Lady of the Virgins. Buying her a Jewish star or a Unitarian flaming chalice before Grandma Frances hung a crucifix over Gracie's bed went on her to-do list. Mixed marriage only went so far. "Monopoly is better with more people, Caleb." Pregnant women should be required to take classes in referee and negotiation skills, along with breathing and panting lessons. "No, I only want to play with Emma." Gracie pulled at her camp grimy toes. "How about you and I make chocolate sauce while they play?" Maddie suggested. "We could have hot fudge sundaes for supper." "Ice cream for supper?" Gracie raised her chin off her knees. "Why not?" She pushed back her daughter's sweaty black curls, the only visible part of Maddie that Gracie had inherited. The kids divided their parents' parts and shared few. Skinny Caleb had Ben's thick brown hair, Maddie's long lashes and narrow shoulders. Poor Gracie, like Ben, would have to fight a tendency toward getting thick in the middle. Emma, wiry, like Maddie, had her father's sharp cheekbones. Emma rolled her eyes. "Healthy, Mom." "Shut up, Emma," Caleb said. "You shut up, or I won't play with you." "I'll play," Gracie said. "No, Emma picked me. Wash my cut, Mommy."
That was Accidents of Marriage by Randy Susan Myers. National Book Award winner Jonathan Kozol is best known for his 50 years of work among our nation's poorest and most vulnerable children. The Theft of Memory, Losing My Father One Day at a Time, is his most personal book. He tells the story of his father's life and work as a nationally noted specialist in disorders of the brain and his father's astonishing ability at the onset of Alzheimer's to explain the causes of his sickness and then to narrate, step by step, his slow descent into dementia. Dr. Harry Kozel was born in Boston in 1906. Classically trained at Harvard and Johns Hopkins, he was an intuitive clinician with a gift for diagnosing interwoven elements of neurological and psychiatric illness in highly complicated and creative people. One of the most intense relationships of his career, his son recalls, was with Eugene O'Neill, who moved to Boston in the last years of his life so my father could examine him and talk with him almost every day. Later in his career, Dr. Kozel evaluated criminal defendants, including Patty Hearst and the Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo, who described in detail what ran through his mind during his murder spree of 13 women. The Theft of Memory, performed by Sean Renette, is a tender tribute to a father from his son and a richly colored portrait of a devoted doctor.
He was determined to complete some papers he'd begun. Summations of ideas that he'd developed in the course of his career on the neurological and psychiatric origins of certain forms of pathological behavior. A friend of mine, a teaching assistant at a local university, was helping him to organize his thoughts and bring coherence to his writing. On occasion, when my father asked, I would help him too. It was not long after this, however, that my father's restlessness would overcome his capability for concentration. After an hour or two of work, he would push the pages aside, get up from his desk, put on his jacket and an overcoat if it was cold weather, go down to the lobby of the building, and head off into the nearby streets for another of his evening journeys. One night in 1992, he asked me to sit down with him in a room of his apartment that he'd been using to store an old examination table and some other items from his former office. He said there was something he needed to discuss with me. He told me that he hadn't yet decided whether it was wise to discuss this with my mother. After he had closed the door and both of us were seated, he started to lay out to me, in fairly graphic terms, what he described as new and more specific indications of problems he was having, which he said were clearly neurological. He checked again to be sure the door was firmly closed, and then began explaining to me what he meant by more specific indications. He said that he'd been having spells. He added that he did not mean by this the incidence of memory loss, which he called amnestic spells, but something of a different order altogether. He spoke of these as brief attacks of interrupted consciousness, during which he recognized a sudden cutoff from my own surroundings, a definite blocking of capacity, lasting maybe only for a millisecond or for several seconds or a trifle more. These episodes, he said, had been preceded in each instance by an aura of impending danger that he likened to the sense of warning epileptics often feel just prior to a seizure. He did not say this with the urgent sense of self-concern one might expect a series of events like these would ordinarily arouse. Instead, he spoke as if he was attempting to position these events at a distance from himself, so that he could speak of them with the detachment of an interested observer. I can pinpoint this as a neurologist, he said, and he speculated that his recollection of what he'd been observing in himself might hold potential value for clinicians and researchers. For this reason, he plugged in his office tape machine, which he'd used to dictate letters and reports on patients he was treating, and he recorded the remainder of our conversation. He said that the amnestic spells were clear-cut indications of degeneration of the cells in the cortex of the brain and in the hippocampus, and he showed me, by the placement of his hand, exactly where the hippocampus lies. He speculated also that many strokes of very short duration, which he termed a vascular phenomenon, were in all likelihood the reason for his episodes of interrupted consciousness. Even more specific was the detail that he brought to the portrayal of that aura of anticipation that preceded this. He described it as a feeling of uncommon and uncomfortable heat, a hood of heat, as it were, that someone or some unknown force is drawing down over my forehead and my eyes, as far down maybe as my chest or throat. And in another and, to me, more memorable phrase, a feeling of impending desecration of my own autonomy. a premonition of my imminent removal from contextual reality. During that experience, or intermingled somehow with the loss of consciousness that followed, my father told me he was suddenly aware of a very bright light, like that of a locomotive bearing down upon you in a station. But then, after a moment of reflection, he corrected this from singular to plural. No, not a single light. Many lights. And then, as if he was, step by step, retrieving the experience with more and more precision, he said, "I'm now recalling it more clearly. This was not a static light. It was more like flashing lights coming up in rhythm, thousands of lights shooting upward, and symmetrical."
That was Theft of Memory by Jonathan Kozel. In Holt, Colorado, Addie Moore pays an unexpected visit to a neighbor, Louis Waters. Her husband had died years ago, as had his wife. His daughter lives hours away in Colorado Springs, her son even farther away in Grand Junction. Addie and Louis have long been living alone, their nights lonely, in houses empty of family. Our Souls at Night by popular author Kent Harif chronicles their adventures, their pleasures, and their difficulties to create a story critics state you won't soon forget. Mark Bramwell narrates.
Addie came right away. "Well, you're looking better. Come in." Her hair was brushed back from her face, and she looked pretty. They sat, as before, at the kitchen table and drank and talked a little. Then she said, "I'm ready to go up. Are you?" "Yes." She set their glasses in the sink, and he followed her upstairs. He went to the bathroom and got into his pajamas and folded his clothes in the corner. She was in bed in her nightgown when he entered the bedroom. She drew back the covers and he lay down. "You didn't leave your pajamas here last time. That was another reason I didn't think you were coming back. I thought it would look presumptuous, like I was taking this for granted. We hadn't really even said much yet." "Well, you can leave your pajamas and toothbrush here from now on," she said. "It'll save wear and tear on paper sacks," he said. "Yes, exactly. Do you have something in mind you want to talk about?" she said. "Not anything urgent, just to start talking." "I'm full of questions, mostly." "I have some, too," she said. "But what are yours?" "I wondered why you picked me. We don't really know each other very well. Did you think I would just pick anyone? That I just want anybody to keep me warm at night? Just any old person to talk to?" "I didn't think that. But I don't know why you picked me." "Are you sorry I did?" "No, it's not that at all. I'm just curious. I wondered." "Because I think you're a good man. A kind man." "I hope I am." "I think you are. And I've always sort of thought of you as someone I might be able to like and to talk to. How have you thought of me, if you ever have?" "I've thought of you," he said. "In what way?" "As a good-looking woman, someone with substance, character." "Why would you say that?" "Because of how you live, how you managed your life after Carl died. That was a hard time for you," he said. "That's what I mean. I know what it was like for me after my wife died, and I could see that you were doing better than I did. I admired that." "You never came over or made a point of saying anything," she said. "I didn't want to seem intrusive." "You wouldn't have. I was very lonely. I assumed that, but still didn't do anything." "What else do you want to know?" "Where you came from, where you grew up, what you were like as a girl, what your parents were like, if you have brothers or sisters, how you met Carl, what's your relationship with your son, why you moved to Holt, who your friends are, what you believe, what party you vote for.
That was Our Souls at Night by Ken Tariff. What if your beloved fiancé, he of the crinkly smile and the irresistible British accent, has kept a life-changing secret from you? And what if, just a week before your dream wedding, you discovered it? When these questions become realities for bride-to-be Georgia Ford, she does the only thing that seems to make sense. She runs. She hops in her car and drives through the night from L.A. to Sonoma, to her safe haven, to her messy and loving family and their family winery. And on the eve of the harvest, Georgia knows she'll find solace and distraction in familiar rituals. But when Georgia arrives home, nothing is familiar. Her parents, her brothers, the family business are all unrecognizable. It seems her fiancé isn't the only one who's been keeping secrets. Much to Georgia's dismay, this harvest could be the family's last. Set in the backdrop of Sonoma's wine country, 800 Grapes by Laura Dave is a heartbreaking, funny, and evocative novel about love, marriage, family, and the treacherous terrain in which they all intersect. Joy Osmansky performs the book.
The legend goes, and knowing my parents, I almost believe it, that my mother didn't scream. She didn't ask who my father was or what he was doing in her car. She offered one of her magical smiles and said, "I was wondering what took you so long." Then she reached out her hand for the cup of coffee he was ready to give her. "Synchronization," my father would say. This was a very big word for him. Synchronization, the coordination of events to operate in union. A conductor managing to keep his orchestra in time. The impossible meeting of light reflection and time exposure that leads to a perfect photograph. Two yellow bugs parked in front of Lincoln Center at the same time, the love of your life in one of them. Not fate, my father would add. Don't confuse it with fate. Fate suggests no agency. Synchronization is all about agency. It involves all systems running in a state where different parts of the system are almost, if not precisely, ready. For my father, it was the basis of how he approached his work, first as a scientist, then as a winemaker. He was one of the first biodynamic winemakers in America, certainly in his little corner of it. He considered not just the grapes themselves, but, as he liked to espouse, the ecological, social, and economic systems that needed to be synchronized in order to properly grow them. My father said that doing it any other way was lazy. As for me, I had trouble seeing the role synchronization played in my own life, the role it was supposed to play, until it went and destroyed my blessedly ignorant, willfully optimistic life in a way I couldn't ignore unless I ran from it. So, on that fateful Friday, I did just that. I ran from it. With only the clothes on my back and a hastily packed suitcase, I drove from sunny Southern California, the place that had been my home for the last 14 years, to the small town in Northern California on the edge of the Russian River Valley, the place that had been my home for my entire life until then. 9 hours, 5 rest spot stops, 2 terrible milkshakey coffee drinks, 1 vanilla, 1 strawberry, and a roll of Rolos later, I arrived in Sonoma County. I should have felt relief, but as I passed the familiar sign for Sebastopol, its wiry hills visible behind it, I caught a glimpse of myself in the rearview. My hair was falling out of its bun, my eyes were deeply unsettled, and I couldn't escape the feeling that I was about to walk into a new kind of hell. So I turned around and started driving the 9 hours back to Los Angeles. But it was getting late, and I hadn't eaten, save the Rolos, and the rain was coming down hard, and I was so tired I couldn't think. So I pulled off Highway 12, getting off at the exit for downtown Santa Rosa, knowing where I was going before I admitted it to myself. The Brothers Tavern was something of a Sonoma County institution. The original owners and brothers had opened the doors 78 years ago with the idea that it would be the place in the county that was open late and the place that served the best beer. The subsequent owners had stuck with the plan, taking the bar and grill to another level, brewing award-winning beer on site that drew people from all over the state. Of course, the current owners of the Brothers Tavern were my brothers, Finn and Bobby Ford. And the jig would be up as soon as they saw me. They would see it on my face, what I had been through. But when I walked into the bar, Finn was the only one standing there. No Bobby. Bobby was always there on the weekends, so this was the first confusing thing. The fact that my father wasn't sitting on the corner bar stool having a drink with them was the second. My father came by every Friday. The only way to start his weekend, he liked to say, was to have a drink with his boys. My heart dropped in disappointment, realizing that this was really why I had shown up, despite the ramifications, so that my father would have a drink with his girl, jig up or not.
We've just heard a sample of 800 Grapes by Laura Dave. Dorothea Benton Frank returns with an emotionally resonant novel illuminating the power of friendship. All the Single Ladies is filled with her trademark wit, sassy true-to-life characters, and the beauty of the Carolina Lowcountry. As the story opens, three middle-aged women are bonded by another woman's death. Through their shared loss, they forge a deep friendship, asking critical questions. Who was their friend? What did her life mean? Are they living the lives they imagined for themselves? How can they maximize their happiness? A plan is conceived and unfurls with each turn of the tide during one sweltering summer on the Isle of Palms. Robin Miles performs the book.
June 2014. I hail from a very theatrical climate. Coming to terms with Mother Nature is essential when you call the Lowcountry of South Carolina home. At the precise moment I ventured outside early this morning, my sunglasses fogged. In the next breath, I swatted a mosquito on the back of my neck. The world was still. The birds were quiet. It was already too hot to chirp. And, Lord save us, the heat was just beginning to rise. I thought the blazes of hell itself could not be this inhospitable. But that was exactly how a typical summer day would be expected to unfold. The temperature would climb steadily from the mid-70s at sunrise to the edges of 90 degrees by noon. All through the day, thermometers across the land would inch toward their worst. Around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, the skies would grow black and horrible. After several terrifying booms and ear-splitting cracks of thunder and lightning, lights would flicker, computers reboot, and the heavy clouds burst as rain fell, jungle style, fast and furious. Natives and tourists declared it bourbon weather and tucked themselves into the closest bar to knock back a jigger or two. Then, suddenly, without warning, the deluge stops. The sun slowly reemerges, and all is right with the world. The good news, the stupefying heat of the day is broken, and the sun begins its lazy descent. The entire population of the Lowcountry, man and beast, breathes a collective sigh of relief. Even though every sign had pointed to impending catastrophe, the world, in fact, did not come to an end. After 5 o'clock in downtown Charleston, gentlemen in seersucker linen or madras, wafting a faint trail of Royal Bay rum, would announce to freshly powdered ladies in optimistic chintz that it appeared the sun had once again traveled over the yardarm. Could he tempt her with an iced adult libation? She would smile and say, "That would be lovely. Shall we imbibe on the piazza? I have some delicious cheese straws. Or deviled eggs, or pickled shrimp, or creamy spread enhanced with minced herbs from their garden." Ceiling fans would stir and move the warm evening air while they recounted their leisurely days in sweet words designed to charm. By 6 or 7 in the evening, across the city, in all the slick new restaurants with dozens of craft beers and encyclopedic wine lists, corks were being pulled. Freezing cold vodka and gin were slapping against designer ice cubes in shiny clacking shakers, with concoctions designed by a mixologist, whose star was ascending on a trajectory matched with his ambition. Hip young patrons in fedoras and tight pants, impossibly high heels and short skirts, picked at small plates of house-cured salami and caponata. At less glamorous watering holes, crab dip was sitting on an undistinguished cracker. Boiled peanuts dripping with saline goodness were being cracked open, and pop-tops were popping. An afternoon cocktail was a sacred tradition in the Holy City, and had been as far back as the war. Charlestonians, natives, and the imported did not fool around with traditions, no ma'am, even if your interpretation of tradition meant you'd prefer iced tea to bourbon. When the proper time arrived, the genteel privileged, the hipsters, and the regular folks paused for refreshment. If you were from elsewhere, you observed. We were so much more than a sea-drinking city. But I was hours away from any kind of indulgence, and it was doubtful I'd run into someone with whom I could share a cool one in the first place. To be honest, I was a juicer and got my thrills from liquefied carrots and spinach, stocking up when they were on special at the buy-low. And I was the classic case of table for one, please. Such is the plight of the middle-aged divorcee. I had surrendered my social life ages ago.
We've just heard All the Single Ladies by Dorothea Benton Frank. Aziz Ansari's Modern Romance explores our journeys to find love. We meet people, date, get in and out of relationships, all with the hope of finding that special someone. Single people today have more romantic options than at any point in human history. With technology, our abilities to connect with and sort through these options are staggering. So why are so many people frustrated? Some of our problems are unique to our time. Why did this guy just send me an emoji of a pizza? My girlfriend just got a message from some dude named Nathan. Who's Nathan? But the transformation of our romantic lives can't be explained by technology alone. In a short period of time, the whole culture of finding love has changed dramatically. A few decades ago, people would find a decent person who lived in their neighborhood. Their families would meet, they would marry, and start a family, usually by the time they were 24. Today, people marry later than ever and spend years of their lives on a quest to find their soulmate. For years, Aziz Ansari has been aiming his comic insight at modern romance. But for Modern Romance the book, he took things to another level. He teamed up with NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg and designed a massive research project, including hundreds of interviews and focus groups from Tokyo to Buenos Aires to Wichita. The authors perform the book.
Hey, don't know if you left for NYC, but Beach House playing tonight and tomorrow at Wiltern. You want to go? Question mark. Maybe they'll let you cover the motto if we ask nicely. Question mark. All right, this is a little audiobook aside. I know it's weird I said question mark, but, you know, when you're sending texts and stuff, the punctuation and stuff can be very, very important. So that's why I said question mark. Anyway, back to the book. A nice firm with a little inside joke thrown in. Tanya was singing the Drake song, The Motto, at the party and impressively knew almost all the lyrics. I was pretty confident. I wasn't head over heels in love with Tanya, but she seemed really cool, and it felt like we had a good connection. As I waited for a response, I started picturing our hypothetical relationship. Perhaps next weekend we would go see a movie at the cool outdoor screening series they do at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Maybe I could cook Tanya dinner later this week and try out that brick chicken recipe I'd been eager to attempt. Would Tanya and I go vacation in Ojai later in the fall? Who knew what our future would be? This was gonna be great. A few minutes went by, and the status of my text message changed to red. My heart stopped. This was a moment of truth. I braced myself and watched as those little iPhone dots popped up, The ones that tantalizingly tell you someone is typing a response. The smartphone equivalent of the slow trip up to the top of a roller coaster. But then, in a few seconds, they vanished. And there was no response from Tanya. What happened? A few more minutes go by and nothing. No problem. She's probably just crafting her perfectly witty response. She started a draft, didn't feel good about it, and wanted to get back to it later. I get it. She also probably didn't want to seem overeager and be writing back so fast, right? 15 minutes go by. Nothing. My confidence starts going down and shifting into doubt. An hour goes by. Nothing. 2 hours go by. Nothing. 3 hours go by. Nothing. A mild panic begins. I start staring at my original text. Once so confident, now I second guess it all. Hey, don't know if you left for NYC, but Beach House playing tonight and tomorrow at the Wiltern. You want to go? Maybe they'll let you cover the motto if we ask nicely. I'm so stupid. Should have typed hey with two Y's, not just one. I asked too many questions. What the f*** was I thinking? Oh, there I go again with another question. Aziz, what's up with you and the questions? I'm struggling to figure it out, but trying to keep calm. Okay, maybe she's busy with work. No big deal. I'm sure she'll get back to me as soon as she can. We had a connection, right? A f***ing day goes by. A full day. Now my thoughts get crazier. What has happened? I know she held my words in her hand. Did Tanya's phone fall into a river slash trash compactor slash volcano? Did Tanya fall into a river slash trash compactor slash volcano? Oh no, Tanya has died and I'm selfishly worried about our date. I'm a bad person. I shared my dilemma with a friend. Aw, come on, man. It's fine. She'll get back to you. She's probably just busy, he said optimistically. Then I look on social media. I see her logged onto Facebook chat. Do I send a message? No, don't do that, Aziz. Be cool, be cool. Later, I check Instagram, and this clown Tanya is posting a photo of some horse. Too busy to write me back, but she has time to do a photo shoot with some horse she saw on a hike? I'm distraught, but then I have a moment of clarity that every idiot has in this situation. Maybe she didn't get the text. Yes, that's what happened, right? There was a glitch in her phone of some sort. Of course. This is when I contemplate a second text, but I'm hesitant due to the fact that this scenario has never happened with my friends. Hey, Alan, I texted you to go get dinner and you didn't write me back for a full day. What happened? Damn, I didn't see the text. It didn't go through. Glitch in my phone. Sorry about that. Let's grab dinner tomorrow. Back to the Tanya situation. At this point, it's been more than 24 hours. It's Wednesday. The concert is tonight. To not even write back and say no, why would she do that? At least say no so I can take someone else, right? Why, Tanya, why? I start going nuts thinking about it. How can this person be so rude on so many levels? I'm not just some bozo. She's known me for years. I kept debating whether I should send anything, but I felt it would just be too desperate and accepted that she wasn't interested. I told myself that I wouldn't want to go out with someone who treats people that way anyway, which was somewhat true, but I was still beyond frustrated and insulted. Then I realized something interesting. The madness I was descending into wouldn't have even existed 20 or even 10 years ago. There I was, maniacally checking my phone every few minutes, going through this tornado of panic and hurt and anger, all because this person hadn't written me a short, stupid message on a dumb little phone. I was really upset, but had Tanya really done anything that rude or malicious? No, she just didn't send a message in order to avoid an awkward situation. I'd surely done the same thing to someone else and not realize a similar grief I'd possibly caused them.
That was a sampling of Modern Romance by Aziz Ansari and Eric Kleinenberg. Readers, the actor Michael J. Fox got it so right. He said, family is not an important thing, it's the only thing. And family certainly is at the heart of the world's greatest stories. For more titles worthy of your time, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. With so many titles releasing this summer, let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.